Hi, it's Radhika Jones, Editor-in-Chief of Vanity Fair. If you love digging into the week's political headlines, subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our reporters take you behind the scenes of some of the biggest stories from the campaign trail to the halls of Congress. Just for our Inside the Hive listeners, save 15% on a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair with promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off 1 year of all you can read, watch, and hear.
AI is making waves in every field it touches. President Biden is now on TikTok, and the election draws closer each day. With so much going on in the world, it is hard to keep up with it all, let me tell you. Hi, I'm Kai Ryssdal, the co-host of Make Me Smart. It's a podcast from Marketplace. And every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I break down the latest in business and the economy with short daily episodes to make it easy for you to stay in the know. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
I am sitting in my home office, and I have a gentleman in front of me who I've never met before, who, on a whim, ended up here, probably took a wrong turn. Can you tell me who you are?
Yeah, I'm the guy that walked in off the street, right?
He's just some random guy that walked in off the street. I was walking my dog, and we
did take a couple wrong turns to get here. But yeah. So my name is Jay Huelings. I'm a candidate for Congress in Texas, Texas 23, which is a big district that stretches from San Antonio all the way to El Paso, with a huge chunk of the border, U.S.-Mexico border. And I've been in this race about 2 months. Before that, I was a federal prosecutor in San Antonio and Del Rio, which is a little town on the river, on the border. And before that, I was a staffer on Capitol Hill. I worked on the House Intelligence Committee staff. I was a counsel. And before that, I worked for Congresswoman Jane Harman of California, was her legislative director, basically her lead policy advisor.
So you're running around America talking to people about this race in 2018, which is a pretty important one, to say the least, right?
Yeah, we think so. Yeah. Well, it's one of the top targets in the country for a variety of reasons.
The race that you're in.
Yes.
Got it.
And partly it's because Hillary Clinton won this district by 4 points, but it's held by a Republican who narrowly won it. And it's one of those seats where if the Democrats are going to take back the House, they kind of have to win this seat and seats like it. And so it's high stakes. You know, eventually we expect between both sides the race to cost $20-30 million, which is kind of incredible for a mostly rural West Texas seat.
And so how did you end up running? And I have a lot of questions about your background that we'll get into in a second, but how did you end up running there? Like what you're
it's a good question. I get it a lot. I didn't grow up in Texas. I did go to high school in Texas. I went to high school in Austin, Westwood High School in Northwest Austin. But I know we'll get into it. My parents are now retired CIA, so we moved every couple of years.
So you grew up with parents who were in the Central Intelligence Agency?
Yeah, they were undercover almost my entire life.
And where were you born?
Italy. I was born in Rome, Italy.
And did you know, what age did you realize mom and dad had worked for the CIA and I'm technically a spy?
13.
13.
Yes.
What was that?
When we were overseas, most of 10 of my first 13 years were overseas. And we bounced around every couple of years and parents are mostly working out of embassies. I thought they were diplomats. But we come back to the States and, you know, we're not in Washington, D.C. We're elsewhere in Virginia. And it started to dawn on me, like, what are we doing here? And my dad pulled me aside and said, hey, this is what I do for a living. I'm a spy. Your mom's a spy.
Was he allowed to tell you that?
Yeah, it's sort of expected that when your kid's at 13 or 14, it's called, they're witting.
It's called what, sorry?
Witting, W-I-T-T-I-N-G. Mm. And it's, so agency kids are deemed to have a secret level security clearance at 13 because they're presumed at around that age to learn what their parents do. It's an interesting thing to put on a kid, though, because it's, hey, here's this national security secret. You have to keep it. And it's sometimes a lot to swallow. For the most part, I did. And, you know, some of my close friends knew. And I went to Virginia Tech for college. And Tech is an interesting place because it's a lot of Northern Virginia kids. So out of my good friends, a couple of them were agency kids, a couple of them were military kids. And so we were a little more open about our parents' background in that environment because everybody came from the same world. But I remember when my dad told me, I kind of figured out something was not quite right. And he told me, he and my mom told me. And my first question is, a 13-year-old boy is, do you kill people?
That was my first question.
That's right. And he kind of rolled his eyes and said, no, that's not what this job is. I mean, he said, look, we go to cocktail parties. You've seen a lot of those cocktail parties. We've got people from all sorts of different nationalities and different embassies, and you develop friendships and you find people who are dissatisfied with where they work or their country, and you convince them to betray their country, usually for money.
Hmm.
And it's a long process. It takes years of usually friendship and the right kind of, you have to make the source feel comfortable. And then you have to handle them delicately. And there's a lot of tradecraft that goes into how you meet with them and how you communicate with them and all of that. But my parents are Cold War people, and they're mostly chasing Russians. And they, they've had training. My dad's jumped out of airplanes and had to.
Did you ask them if they ever feared for their safety, or did you fear for their safety? Or
no, I mean, I guess I didn't ask that because I sort of knew the environment we were in and it felt comfortable.
Mm.
I mean, there was definitely, the 80s in Europe was, particularly in Greece, I mean, the station chief was killed in Athens, brutally, actually.
Yeah.
And there's a fair amount of violence targeted toward American diplomats, and that usually at agency people, when they're identified specifically, that's why the cover is so important. So, I was always aware of that, and I guess the extra added dimension of the agency maybe tweaked it a little bit, but I was always sort of aware that, you have to be careful when you're walking around, even in European capitals. You have to, be wary of strangers. It's not that different than being in a big city here, frankly.
So how did you go from living all over the place, parents of CIA,
to running for Congress
in Texas?
So it's kind of an interesting story. So I went to high school in Austin, so I knew some bit of Texas. And then, of course, back east for college, and then I went to Harvard for law school, and I met Julian and Joaquin Castro. And we became friends. We were in the same class. There's not that many people with Texas ties, so we found each other pretty quickly. That'll become important later. So when I got out of school, I clerked for a judge. Just happened to be out here in California, and I thought I'd try on Los Angeles. And I was like, well, look, I haven't really grown up anywhere. Let's try California.
And what year? When is this?
This was 2001.
Okay.
And so I went to a law firm here. Had a good experience, and 3 or 4 years here. But I always knew I wanted to do public service, and so I kind of felt a calling to leave the firm and do something else. And so get to Thanksgiving of 2004. My parents are overseas. They're in Uruguay, so it's too far to go for Thanksgiving. It's a 9-hour flight. And my little sister was in grad school in San Antonio, St. Mary's University. And so we decided to go there for Thanksgiving. And she had a very good friend who I hadn't met yet and who would just happen to be Miss San Antonio. And so I told my sister, you need to introduce me to your friend. And the same time I called the Castro brothers, hey, we're coming to town. Let's get together. So we all go out together. And Miss San Antonio and I hit it off. She's now my wife. And the same night, Julian Castro said, hey, why don't you quit your job at that law firm and come work for me? I'm going to run for mayor. This will be fun. So you put those two things together, and I decided, yeah, I'm going to do this. So I quit the job, drove east, came to San Antonio, and worked on Julian's 2005 mayoral campaign.
And so what is it like being... I mean, I kind of imagine, I think of like the movie The Martian, and this guy that gets stuck on this planet where the whole planet is trying to expel him. What is it like being a Democrat in Texas?
You know, it's there's a lot more Democrats there than people realize. I mean, so take the last presidential. Hillary lost Texas by 9 points without putting any effort or money in. She lost Ohio by 10. She lost Iowa by 11. Texas, with no effort, was closer than those battleground states. The cities in Texas are pretty Democratic.
So you're talking about like Austin, Houston, places.
San Antonio, Dallas, even Fort Worth, even Houston, Harris County, which is where Houston is, went solidly Democratic for the first time this last cycle. City of San Antonio has traditionally been pretty Democratic. Austin, of course, is very liberal. So the cities have always had their own sort of version of, you know, Texas Democrats. It's not the Democratic Party you would find out here in California or in New York. It's its own thing. But it exists, and it's, you know, 40-something percent and growing. So there is a real possibility over the years, as demographics change, as organization improves, to be able to compete statewide.
So do you think that there's a world in which, as the cities continue to grow, that, excuse the military helicopters flying above us right now.
Sure.
do you think there's a world where Texas becomes a blue state?
I think purple state is realistic.
A purple state.
Yeah. So, I mean, it could.
And
it
does
could
that mean a purple state is that it would win democratically, or?
It will go sometimes blue and sometimes red. And, you know, I know there's, you know, the Castros are old, longtime friends of looking at it very carefully and are going to pick their spots. But I think there's, you know, paying attention to the number of people that move in from out of state, and there are a lot, people like me, frankly. And there's just the demographics of the state by itself are changing. It's a minority-majority state. That's a big and growing Hispanic population. Now, you have to understand, though, that just because people are Hispanic doesn't mean they necessarily vote lockstep Democratic, particularly in Texas.
Well, it's because the issue for them, I mean, I have friends that are of this ilk, and the issue is not, they don't think about anything but maybe abortion or gay rights or things like that, and right?
Yeah. Well, and it depends regionally. I mean, so, you know, my mom's Mexican-American. She's from Tucson, Arizona. And, you know, she's, so, you know, when, I remember I had a conversation with my grandfather when I was 8 or 9 years old, and, you know, I asked him, you know, Pap, are you Mexican? Are we Mexican? What does that mean exactly? And he used it as an opportunity to tell his grandson about the history of his family. And he said, look, the Garcias have been in Tucson, Arizona since there's been a Tucson, Arizona. We were here when it was Spain. We're here when it's Mexico. We're here now. We didn't cross the border. The border crossed us. But, you know, there's, you know, he had family that had gone back and was living in Nogales, and people went back and forth. And his mom and her whole generation, and I mentioned his mom because she lived a long time, she only spoke Spanish, like even well into the 1980s, and not a word of English, didn't assimilate with the rest of Anglo-American society at all. And but my grandfather and his younger brothers and sisters did. English language schools, he served in the military in World War II as an officer, as a squadron commander of a pretty famous fighter pilot squadron. He, you know, it's an integrated unit. And, you know, had this, he made his way into the middle class using military service. GI Bill got him an associate's degree as an accountant. He took a job with the state of Arizona and raised his two kids to go forward. You know, grab your piece of America. Don't retreat back into the bubble where he came from.
Yeah.
And, you know, my mom did that when she joined the CIA, and he was very proud of her, and he was very proud of me. And I didn't quite understand how until he died. And I'd just gotten out of law school, and I went back for the funeral. And I learned that at his request, he was buried in a Harvard Law School t-shirt. Hmm. So of all the things that he had seen and all that he had done, that's what he chose to take to the grave with him. And, you know, yeah, it's because he's proud of me, but I think it's something else. You know, he's saying that, you know, his family had finally made it in America.
Yeah.
And, you know, that for people like me, who've been the beneficiary of the work of others, you know, we all stand on other people's shoulders. Like, a lot of us have a story like that. And I could tell a version of that story with my German-Irish grandparents on my dad's side. But there's a strong element of that in Texas, because you know San Antonio's approaching its 300th anniversary. San Antonio's been around a long time, and it was Spanish when it started. Parts of El Paso are actually older. So, you know, people have been here for a very, very long time, but they haven't always been included in the political system. They haven't been, certainly as, you know, the post-Civil War and all of that, they're really discriminated against and treated differently. So there's always been this sort of old Mexican-American world that's been at the heart of Texas. But you take that and you add on top of that recent waves of immigration, and both from within, from elsewhere in the United States and outside of the country. And you build on top of that core, and you're getting to the point where you're close to 50%.
So this week, Virginia.
Yeah.
You know, the Democrats in New Jersey, too. It was a good week, right?
Yeah.
Would you say yes,
yes.
Maybe?
Yes. I think so, yeah.
What percentage, I mean, what do you think is playing a role in that, and how do you think it's going to play out in 2018? There's a lot of people, you know, there is the assumption that this is a wave against Trump. There is an assumption that this is a wave against the incredibly conservative and, in my opinion, quite disgusting views of some of the Republicans that were running, especially, I mean, Chris Christie, I think, should be in jail, personally. That's my personal opinion. And the stuff that's gone on in Virginia, I think, is just disgusting. And I wonder how much of that has been the response, and it's just that state thing. Do you think that when we get around to 2018, which is arguably probably the most important election year we've had in God knows how long because of the potentialities of what Trump can and cannot do, do you think that this wave will continue, or what do you think is going to happen?
Well, I'm kind of making the bet that it will.
But what are you guys doing in the Democratic Party that's really kind of getting that message across?
So I think that, you know, when people say the Democratic Party, I think they assume that there's some kind of core leadership, cohesion, organized effort. It's much more ad hoc. And, you know, when I decided to run, you know, I had friends who were involved, the Castros and others, who encouraged me. And, you know, I got a lot of support from the DCCC, but I've never had any contact with anybody from the DNC, for example. And, you know, there's no one really in charge right now.
Charge of the DNC?
The Democratic Party, generally.
Yeah.
Like, there's no...
Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
I think it's a good thing, because it enables all of us out here in places like Texas to remake the Democratic Party in the way we think it should be made. And you get a little bit of freedom to do what you think is right for your district. That's how I'm viewing it and how I'm acting anyway. And, you know, I always thought for districts like this, which is a 50-50 basically seat, that, Hillary plus four seat, the Republican won by a point and a half. So very much in play. Traditionally, people thought that for these type of seats, you have to be kind of hard to define and a little bit all over a lot of issues and hedging and sort of mushy. And I think that was something that was imposed from more powerful authorities within a centrally organized institution. And we don't really have that right now. And I personally don't view the way to win these seats as that kind of middle of the road, mushy way. I think you have to have clearly defined positions and be ready to defend them. They may just not all be on the left. So, I think it's going to, I'm going to make the point to people, it's going to be hard to categorize me, because I'm going to be on the left on some things and not on others.
So let's go through a list of things.
Sure.
Gun control.
So I'm a gun owner, supported the Second Amendment, but I spent a lot of time as a federal prosecutor. We haven't talked about this yet, but so the last 7 years before I left to do this job, I was a federal prosecutor in Del Rio on the border and in San Antonio. And a lot of the cases I worked on were trying to keep guns out of the hands of the drug cartels. And, you know, you may or may not know, or your listeners may not know, that most of the guns that are the Zetas and the Sinaloa cartel and the Gulf cartel, some of the most dangerous organizations on the planet, most of their guns come from the United States. They're smuggled out of the United States to Mexico.
And So the guns that these cartels are using,
yes,
are they bought legally or illegally? How are they? Are they?
Well, that's just it. I mean, a little bit of both, but mostly places like gun shows. So here's an example. So there's a case that I worked on. There's a guy named Lascano Lascano. He was the leader of the Zeta cartel, and he was killed by the
Zeta cartel.
Yeah. So
one of the big three.
That's right. And they controlled. I spent a lot of time working Zeta cases because they had the part of the border that we had. And so Lascano Lascano was killed by Las Marinas, the Mexican Marines, in Mexico several years ago. And among the guns that was found with him was an AK-47. The Zetas were sloppy, and they didn't scratch out the serial number. So me, working with ATF and HSI, we were able to trace that gun back, buyer by buyer, witness by witness, to a couple guys at a gun show in San Antonio. And we actually prosecuted them and convicted them. They went to jail.
Wow.
But, you know, gun shows don't have to do background checks. Nope. They don't have to maintain any kind of paperwork. They just got to, people just walk up there. You can buy five AR-15s and walk out the door. And that's what the cartels do. They look for those unregulated spaces, like gun shows. And that's, they exploit those weaknesses.
So what did you charge the two guys with that sold the gun?
So we charged them, so one of them was a felon. So that was easy. Because he was a felon in possession.
Always
so
is, yeah.
Always is. The other we charged with being in the gun selling business without a license, which is a 5-year felony.
And is it that they had sold? Had they sold guns to people in the Mexican cartel, or they had sold them to just random people that had then in turn sold them?
They sold guns to people that they probably, at least they claimed, they didn't know they were in the cartel. And I've prosecuted people for selling guns specifically to the cartel. So that's guns that they know are going outbound. So that's an export control violation. So different law. But with these guys, like, we caught them with 75 assault rifles going to the gun show, and or somewhere around 75. And, you know, basically they couldn't make the argument that they weren't in the business of selling guns if they had that many. And we'd bought several of them. An undercover had bought several of them already. And you know, the gun show, the way the law works with gun shows, the idea is you can sell your personal collection at a gun show. It's just like selling it to your neighbor. But you can't be in the business of selling guns, because then you have to be regulated like a gun store. So the conceit with a lot of the gun shows is, hey, these are just people selling their individual collections. But with these guys, they couldn't make that argument because they were regularly selling, and they were selling a lot, and it was assault rifles. So
would you say you're pro gun or? The reason I ask this question is, how do you feel about AR-15s? Do you think that people should be allowed to have those? Yeah.
So here's the thing: people got to understand about Texas is that everybody has a gun. I have a gun. I have two guns. Uh-huh. Hunting and gun ownership is a very big part of life. And, you know, AR-15s are not used for hunting. And, you know, do people really need to have them for home safety? I mean, probably not. But is it going to help the kind of the spate of violence we've got to go to ban their sale? I don't know that that's going to make – that's a pretty marginal thing in the long run. There are other things you could do. That would be more impactful. So universal background checks. So close that gun show loophole. That's a bigger deal. Making sure that we have that ATF and others have a better sense of who actually has the guns. Because right now that's actually very difficult. So an ATF agent has to actually go to a gun store and look at a piece of paper to determine whether or not a sale's been done. And they can't upgrade that anymore because the law forbids them from upgrading it. It's a little bit crazy. So if you go out and you buy two handguns from a gun store, the gun store has to notify ATF. But if you go buy two AR-15s, they don't.
Why is that?
Because that's just the way the quirks of the law. Because the gun lobby and others fight any potential changes to try and make ATF and other entities' ability to police the gun laws. They want to make that harder.
But how? But does it? How? will it change? I mean, I grew up in England, right?
Yeah.
By the time we are done recording this podcast, there will be more people that have died in America at the hands of guns than will have died in the entire year in the United Kingdom. And it's literally like going back to that Martian analogy. Like, I look around this country sometimes and I think, what the fuck are people thinking?
Yeah.
And then after this latest shooting this week, which 26 people killed in the church, I found myself on the NRA's Twitter feed, and they have this campaign of a good guy with a gun, which they tweet out a story every day of a good guy with a gun who stopped a bad guy, apparently. And there's a story. There was a link on of a TV feed from the president of the NRA. And he was being interviewed in Texas, actually, as a local TV Texas show. And the way he was, the president of the NRA was pushing it is like, you know, we're just this little group of people. We don't have a lot of money. And we're standing up against Mike Bloomberg, a billionaire, and the media, which is hates guns. And it feels like they have no interest in any change whatsoever.
Yeah.
Do you think there ever will be any?
I do, actually.
How?
It's going to take – well, it's not going to happen with a Republican House and Republican Senate, and probably not without a Democratic president. So start there. I mean, you have to have
– okay, but in response to that, we had a Democratic president, a Democratic House. Right. We had Sandy Hook happen and nothing changed.
Yeah, but you didn't have a Democratic House then and at Sandy Hook.
Got it.
You had a Republican House and a Republican Senate.
Yeah.
And the gun lobby has been very good at sort of – at how it handles and scares elected officials. But that is eroding a little bit.
How?
So even gun owners support universal background checks. So I had lunch with a sheriff of Brewster County. Sorry. A couple weeks ago. Brewster is got a big chunk of the border, and it's in West Texas. And, you know, this is a guy who really wants to have the authority to... to arrest illegal aliens who are crossing his part of the territory rather than just calling Border Patrol, hey, you've got people walking down the street. And he owns a gun store, and he's in favor of universal background checks. And so even, I think, a lot of the most hardcore gun folks understand that you got to be able to know where the guns are and be able to keep them from going into the hands of dangerous people. And that erosion, that sort of consensus building, that's new. I think there's actually room to make progress there. But the thing that people got to understand is we have over 330 million guns in this country.
Yeah.
Right? So the idea, you know, what I tell people on the right who are worried about these things is if you think the federal government is interested in or capable in rounding up 330 million guns, you haven't met the federal government. and that kind of goes the other way, too. You got to tell people, look, these things are out there, and you're not going to be able to collect them all.
Yeah.
And so, you know, how do we deal with this problem in a meaningful way that is realistic? And, you know, one way to do that is we got to know where these things are. We got to know who's got them. We got to have some regulations to make sure that every time there's a sale, that we have some way of knowing it's not going to somebody who's got a history of spousal abuse or
escaped from a mental institution
or the like. So one of the jobs I had at the U.S. Attorney's Office is I spent about half of my time when I was in San Antonio doing national security cases. And that's counterterrorism, counterespionage, some counterproliferation. And so counterproliferation meaning we did a case where U.S. technology was going to Iran and we were prosecuting the people that were doing that.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of the counterterrorism cases now involve trying to identify the next Tsarnaev brothers, the next, you know, basically lone wolves who are inspired by ISIS or other organizations and are looking to, you know, take a gun into a shopping center. And so we're trying to find those folks. And sometimes this ends up with, keep it hypothetical, like some dumb kid who follows the wrong people on Twitter.
Yep.
And you have to make the decision of, do we want to make a federal case out of this or do we want to intervene? And more and more, at least under the Obama administration, we would just intervene. And actually, I've seen that work successfully. Somebody who's 16 who's following the wrong people on Twitter, you go and you sit down with his parents and they're like, oh my God. And that effectively shuts it down. But every now and then you come across someone who doesn't have any affiliation with a terrorist organization, but looks like they could be dangerous. And so when we found those folks, we had to be creative because there's not a lot of tools.
So what did you do?
So we usually work with state and local authorities. So if there was a history of mental illness, we could try and get them into a psych hold. If they were in the military, then we could get the military involved and sort of put them in a psych hold. But we didn't know whether or not they had guns. We had to do a lot of surveillance. We had to, a lot of times we would do a hard interview. We'd send the agents in to go talk to them. And a lot of times that just would spook them.
Is it a hard interview when they intentionally spook them?
Kind of, yeah. Hey, we know what you're doing. Be careful. We're watching you. But the thing is, the Bureau's not really looking for those guys. They're looking for the terrorists. Mm. They're not looking for the random one-offs who might go to Las Vegas and knock on a window and shoot a bunch of people. I think we should reevaluate that because I think there's room for, giving a law enforcement agency, and it's probably the FBI, the mission of go find these people and try and shut this down before it happens. And that might, it might, instead of just looking for, terrorist blogs or ISIS Twitter followers, it might be looking in different parts of the internet. Who's talking about this? Asking for tips. Hey, do you think someone's dangerous? And, treat these almost like domestic terrorism cases. There's a whole legal issue about how domestic terrorism is defined, and it's very differently defined than international terrorism. We can get into that if you want. But if we spend more time trying to identify these people and intervene early with and hopefully give people more tools.
You think that there's a way that we can stop some of these things from happening?
I think so. Like the Vegas shooter.
Yeah.
So if ATF had known that this guy bought 30 assault rifles or whatever it was in a couple weeks, they would have intervened. They would have at least interviewed him.
Yeah.
And that those purchases may not have been illegal. They may not have been able to arrest him, but they at least would have talked to him and kept an eye on him. This recent shooting in Sutherland Springs, which is right outside of San Antonio, so it's right down the street. That's a case where the laws and the books should have prevented him from getting a gun.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
It just, the system broke down, which these are human institutions. That does happen. But that's a case where this guy just going to the gun store to try and buy a gun would have been a flag. If the database had been run right.
So let's move on to another topic. So you live in Texas, not far from a little area where there are now 6, I believe, prototypes for a border wall that a certain president made part of his campaign.
Yep.
How do you feel about the wall? How do people in Texas feel about it?
I think the wall is a terrible idea, and most people in Texas think it's a terrible idea. I mean, we have the border in Texas is a river. It's the Rio Grande. Yeah. So you can put the wall in the middle of the river.
It'll be a beautiful wall in the middle of a river.
Or what they're going to do is they're going to run it through a bunch of ranch land.
Yeah.
And so, these ranches that people have had for generations that exist where they are because they have access to water, now you're going to cut off their water supply. It doesn't make any sense. And it's just, it's the sort of thing that people who aren't from the border, who haven't spent time there, think is a good idea. And, the thing that people don't realize is it's not effective.
Oh, it's completely not effective.
I have thousands, literally thousands of border cases, particularly when I was in Del Rio. And, we're talking about drugs and guns and human trafficking and a lot of illegal immigration cases that you just do when you're a border prosecutor. And so I've done a lot of work with the Border Patrol. Okay, what are the drug trafficking routes? How do we make sure that we've got somebody there for the drug trafficking routes? And, if you have a wall, it's only going to work if you've got a Border Patrol agent standing next to it. Otherwise, they'll go over it, under it, through it.
Is there a worry that, or not a worry, or is there a timeline as to when the cartels will start using drones and things like that?
they're already doing that.
So they're already bringing drugs and guns and things through drones?
Well, the thing is, Border Patrol is actually more effective at catching people that are crossing than people give them credit for. And you can tell to some extent by the economics of the drug trade. So cartels only move marijuana with people carrying it across the river.
Why not?
Well, marijuana is relatively cheap by size. So if you've got a backpack of 50 pounds of marijuana, that's maybe 25, 30 grand, at least on the border. Worth more if you get further in, but on the border, it's maybe that amount. If you've got that amount of heroin or cocaine, I mean, the key of coke is probably going to be 20 grand on the border. So suddenly, instead of 20, 25 grand, it's 100, 150 grand. And they don't take that risk because they can't, they can't play the game where they're just throwing quantity at the river and some percentage is going to get through because the individual pack is more important.
So how do they? So they get marijuana through with people. How do they get the coke and the heroin through?
It's in the meth, usually through vehicles at checkpoints.
Huh.
So they drive them in, and you know they if they're doing it right, it's very difficult to detect.
Do they do it that is not detected by the dogs and
gas tanks? So huh. if they wrap it, they put it in the gas tank. It's covered by gasoline. And sometimes the dogs get it. Say there's residue on the fingers, they close the door. A lot of times the dogs will hit on that. We don't have anything technologically superior to a dog's nose still.
That's amazing.
There's always dogs at the checkpoints and at the ports of entry. So people drive in from Mexico. So, all of the most valuable stuff comes in there.
So keeping on this topic, but moving away from dogs and drugs, what are your thoughts on the immigration policies and that are going on right now?
So that's one of the reasons why I'm running. I've done so many of these border cases that it's given me a chance to see not just what works, but what doesn't work, like the little tragedies of the system. So the case in particular that is worth talking about is about a year and a half ago. And I was on duty. I was on call. So we all take turns being on call.
Where were you at this point?
It was in San Antonio. Comes in the middle of the night. Hey, we're going to take this case or not. And you decide whether or not to take it. So there was this one arrest. I think it was in Cotulla. And the defendant had lived in San Antonio for 15 years. He was undocumented. He was a construction worker. And had basically stayed out of trouble. Worked hard, supported his family. And his family was a U.S. citizen wife and three U.S. citizen kids. I think the youngest was 9 or 10 years old. But his mom lived in Tamaulipas, which is in northern Mexico. And she got sick. So he went home to see his mother. Got caught crossing the river on the way back. He'd been deported before, so that's a felony. And, so Border Patrol arrested him. We charged him. I took the case. And he pled guilty because there's really not much of a defense to it. And we got to sentencing. So in front of a federal judge, the judge, me, the defense lawyer, even the agents, everybody agreed on the lowest possible sentence because this guy had...
What is the lowest possible sentence?
It was time served in his case.
Got it.
So I think he'd been in 7-8 months. And because this guy didn't have a violent history or much of a criminal history at all. So we just, he'd been in 7-8 months. That's what he's going to do. But the judge did something unusual. He allowed... this defendant to hug his family before he got sent off to federal prison and then to get deported and sent back to Mexico. So I'm in the courtroom watching this, and it's a difficult, tearful scene. I mean, it's very clear that we're ripping this family apart. And it occurred to me while I'm sitting there, why are we spending our resources on a guy like this? This guy was basically, we as a society have invited him here to do work, work that needed to be done, but we are paying him under the table, which drives down wages. We're making him bear the risk of a difficult border crossing and living life under the threat of arrest and deportation. It's not fair to him. It's not fair to other workers here. It doesn't make any sense, but that's some 85% of the people that we catch are guys like him, economic migrants, and you don't know who they are until you get them. So we're spending all of these resources on people who are coming here just to work and that we all sort of accept as coming here to work. It doesn't make sense, but it's the way the law is written. The law is written one way and the machine goes into autopilot. Everybody in this equation, including me, swore an oath to uphold the law, and that's what we were doing. You can't fix this. You can't change the law. You can't change how immigration policy works without getting into Congress and changing the way the law is written. And it's one of these things where it became clear to me that this is public service where it is most needed. and I've worked in public service my whole life. This is where it's got to be done. This is where it's really going
to
matter.
So you want to change the law to be what?
So comprehensive immigration reform. This idea has been out there for a while. And this is what's part of what's frustrating about this is that every package that's come close to passing, and there's been a couple, came close in the Bush administration, came close under Obama, this bill that got out of the Senate, involved a significant increase in guest worker visas. So a person like this guy would have been able to just use, he would have probably gotten a guest worker visa and would have been able to go back and forth to be able to do work above board, paid, you know, above the at least above the minimum wage. He's in construction, so probably higher than that. But without having to sneak around, without having to break the law, along with a path to citizenship for the people who are here, DACA and legal status for others, and an increase in border security. Like, that deal has been out there and would not only pass the Senate, would have passed the House if they'd put it on the floor. But they didn't, because the half of the Republicans didn't support it. It would have passed with Republican and Democratic support. But because it didn't have majority support among the Republicans, Boehner wouldn't put it on the floor. So the problem persists, and it just drifts and keeps getting worse. And we keep having these little tragedies because the Republican politics are so screwed up that they can't get around to solving a problem that everybody recognizes needs to be solved. And so this problem just persists.
So I do want to talk about the Republican politics being screwed up a little more. But I have just to go back to the story. When that call comes in, are you like in just work mode, and this is mm-hmm. just a number, or are you thinking to yourself, you know, this is a human being who has a family? When you decide to prosecute, and I know you say that the law is the law is the law, but I got pulled over a few weeks back, and the cop was like, "Eh, you seem like a good guy. You missed the stop sign.
Right.
Like, don't worry about it."
Right.
You know, there's a book out there that says we all 3 felonies a day. We all kind of as a prosecutor and as a human being, what's going through your head?
So there's both things. Both is. You know, when you take the case, you don't know anything about the person.
You just hear there's a guy across the border.
Well, yeah, he's undocumented. He's been deported X number of times. Usually, you hear something about a criminal history, and so that's, you've got that sort of data set. Okay, this guy's got a felony conviction for a drug count in the state, and he got deported 3 times, and now he's back. Okay, fine. That hits the prosecution guidelines that the office sets, which are set as part of Maine Justice, and this is in both administrations. Like, here's our policies for how we're going to enforce these laws, and as a line prosecutor, you get this sort of set of, here are the criteria. You're looking for some kind of criminal history, usually, and usually prior deportations before you take these cases. Now, with other cases, it's a little different. I mean, it's, you know, we're talking about reactive cases that just kind of come in. And it's usually like, hey, this guy was arrested at the port of entry. He got 10 keys of coke in the car. He told 3 different stories to the CBP officers when he came in. It's pretty clear he's lying. Okay, fine. That guy we're going to charge. That's most of what these are. But it's, you do learn, I mean, certainly as these cases progress, and usually at sentencing, because that's really when you delve, the court delves into the person's background and history. Because a judge wants to issue a fair sentence, so they need to understand who the person is. That's where you really get into that, on those types of cases. Most of what I did, particularly later in my time, was bigger, proactive cases where we're identifying people who have committed crimes, a lot of public corruption cases, that's a lot of what I did. These people are paying bribes, let's build the case on them. And so you know a lot about them before you charge, and before the process even starts. But yeah, with immigration cases, you're always aware of the humanity. But
so in the courtroom that day, when the families are hugging, was there a part of you that was like, this is just awful? I mean, hearing the story to me just makes me.
No, I would say this, like, this sucks. Like, this isn't why I wanted to be a prosecutor. I wanted to do the big the Kelder cases I was doing, these big cartel cases, I mean, really bad people, politicians taking bribes, you know, people who are working with terrorist organizations. Those are the kind of cases I was mostly doing and preferred to be doing. But everybody's got to do a certain number of these reactive immigration cases. And, you know, I think a lot of us have gone through this system. And I know this is true of a lot of the judges. Kind of recognize that, okay, this is a little silly. This doesn't make a lot of sense. There's a lot of little tragedies here. And you see it a lot in the sentencing. A lot of judges will, particularly visiting judges, will come down to the border and just cut these sentences because it's, when you get to the situation where someone's clearly an economic migrant and not moving drugs or doesn't have a significant criminal history, isn't dangerous, they tend to give lighter sentences. And that's the way actually the law is written. The sentencing guidelines sort of push judges in that direction. But, you know, as I was sitting there, I mean, the reason why I tell the story is because it had an impact on me. Like, I think this is not, he deserves it in the sense that the law is written the way it's written and he's violating the law. But we tolerate, particularly in the immigration context, so much of this sort of wink and a nod, you know, 40% of the agriculture sector is illegal labor. The construction sector may not be quite that high, but it's really significant. And, you know, think about, you drive through a neighborhood and you think the people who are working in these homes and working in gardens and working on the construction road, and a lot of those people are coming here and are undocumented, are not...
They're here because they have families.
And they're invited here. Like, we're asking them to come.
Yeah.
And it's... We're asking them to come and giving, you know, come here and do this work. But we're putting all of the burden on them, and we're putting all of the risk on them. And it's a cruel system, and it doesn't make any sense.
So the question I have to go back to this Republican thing is I literally do not understand how these people like Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell and Donald Trump, I just think is a complete just lunatic. So I won't even put him. I don't think that there's a thought that goes through his head that doesn't have him involved.
Yeah.
But like these true Republicans that, you know, that talk about God and going to church and this, that, and the other, how they don't think about that these are human beings with families. That, as you just said, in many instances we've invited here, we're going to tear their lives apart and separate children from parents and so on and so forth. I mean, you've spoken to these people. Do they have, like, in behind closed doors, do they feel remorse? Do they care?
I don't know that I've had this conversation with Paul Ryan. I've never had a conversation with Paul Ryan, but I don't think they care.
I
don't think it's... I mean, look, you know, I read an interview somewhere where, you know, Paul Ryan was telling a friend in college that, you know, his lifelong dream was to cut Medicaid. You know, lifelong dream is to cut Medicaid, then I don't think you really care about, you know, people that you probably write off as well, they broke a law to get here.
But I guess the question is not just the immigrants, but in Medicaid too, healthcare, all these things, like what...
I think he approaches it from a very different philosophical point of view. And so Medicaid, I've had some personal experience with this. My grandmother, my dad's side, had Alzheimer's. And, you know, my dad and his younger sisters, when it became clear that she was not going to be able to take care of herself, you know, they had to figure out what to do. Neither one of them was going to have to dedicate their lives, essentially, to taking care of her, because she needed that kind of care. Or they were going to be bankrupt trying to pay for the kind of care she needed. Where they ended up, though, is they ended up in a very good facility, and they burned down all of her assets, my grandmother's assets, and Medicaid picked up the rest. And she lived for 10 years in this facility. And there was some out of pocket on my parents and my dad and his sister's side, but it was mostly covered by Medicaid. And, you know, we don't know what situation we're going to be in. Like, I don't know if I'm going to be in that situation. I know I'm not going to want to burden my kids. I know I'm not going to bankrupt my kids to have to take care of me. And we build these systems. We buy insurance and create things like Medicaid because ahead of time, we don't know whether or not we're going to need it. And we want to have a fair as possible system so that if you do happen to be in that situation, that you're covered. And, you know, my grandmother wasn't rich. Her husband was in the, she was an English teacher. And, you know, it's like we were overseas. I would send her letters. She would send them back marked up in red ink. I should go to my dad going, what is this? And he's like, just fixing the mistakes next time.
That's really funny.
And, you know, but, and my grandfather was in the Navy. He was an officer. They had a good middle-class life, but they weren't rich. But they depended on this safety net that they'd contributed to all their life, and it was there for her. And people don't realize that that's part of what Medicaid is. It's not just, I think people have these assumptions that Medicaid is for the poor or for other people, but it might be there for all of us. But even if it is for the poor.
Even if it is for the poor, it's like, it's for the fucking poor. Like these people.
But I don't think Paul, Ryan is starting from a point of view where
I guess it's not
something that we shouldn't be doing at all. Like he's coming from outer space.
To me, it's not just Paul Ryan. It's this Republican contingent that it is just, it literally boggles my mind beyond all comprehension that you can run for office in order to make people's lives more difficult.
You know, I was in El Paso and I was speaking to a group of community college students. And I was asked to define the difference between the two parties. And for Democrats, I thought it was pretty easy. Your Democrats stand for progress and using the tools available to us to solve problems and equal opportunity and justice. That's what the Democrats stand for. The Republicans, you know, 5 years ago, I could have probably given you an answer. But now I don't think they can give you that answer.
No, I agree.
I don't think they have an ideological core anymore. I think they're at the point where they're so, you know, they're basically doing donor service. That's what this tax bill is. They're trying to return as much money as they can to their donors. And it's, you know, it may not be corrupt in the way that I've done public corruption cases, where it's like an envelope of cash slid across the table, but it's corrupt in its own way. And I think when you lose your moral core, when you're at the point where you don't know why you're in government, you're not focused on trying to help people or solve problems, then what are you left with other than donor service? But like, I don't want to overgeneralize these things, because there are Republicans who are focused on trying to solve problems. And you know, when I was on the House Intelligence Committee, I traveled with both Republicans and Democrats all over the world, Yemen, Afghanistan, Egypt, all over, not Egypt, Ethiopia. And so I got to know a lot of these guys really well. And you know, some of them there are some that are how you're describing them, kind of ideological party hacks. But there are others who are focused on trying to solve problems. They're just coming from a different perspective. And you kind of learn to respect their point of view, even though I may not 100% agree with it. We may not agree on the means, but we may agree on the ends. And there are still a good number of those people out there in the Republican Party, and we have to, if we're going to solve any of these problems, we're going to have to work
together.
We have to identify them, create a space where they can work with us, and then focus on solutions that we can all agree on.
So bringing this back as we come to the end of which has been a fascinating discussion. So you're running against a Republican,
yes.
Also a former CIA agent. Do you guys ever go out for beers and like talk about the old CIA days?
You know, the funny thing is, I would, you know, he and I would, we've had brief conversations. I haven't talked in substance with him. And look, he's a pleasant guy. If this wasn't all going on, you know, we've got a lot of people in common. We'd probably be friends, but it's not about, you know, that fact doesn't matter. I mean, even though he's a relatively pleasant person and, you know, doesn't talk in a way that makes him sound really extreme, his voting record is really conservative. 96% with Donald Trump.
96% with Donald Trump.
96% with Donald Trump.
Wow. And is that going to play into your favor?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so what we say is like he's done a very good job of trying to create a moderate image. And, you know, he'll talk when he's back in the district, he'll talk against the wall. And this is what he's tried to use to create a moderate image. I'm opposed to the wall. But when he's back in Washington, he votes to fund it. And it's sort of one of these old Washington stories. There's a big bill going through that funds, part of it funds the wall, and there'll be an amendment to strip out that wall funding that everybody knows is going to fail, otherwise it wouldn't be allowed to hit the floor. He gets to vote for that amendment, which fails. And then he votes for final passage, and he tries to say, well, I voted against it before I voted for it. We're not going to let him get away with that.
How are you not going to let him get away with that?
Well, I mean, we're going to constantly talk about how, look, you voted for the wall. You voted to fund the thing. And he might say, look, there are other things in the bill that I liked. It's like, well, there are other things in the bill that people like Henry Cuellar liked and that others on the border who were congressmen also liked. They voted no because wall funding is important enough for them. All this means is that wall funding wasn't important enough for Will Hurt. And because he voted yes and he could have voted no. But he's an organization man. You know, this is Paul Ryan gives him a little bit of room every now and then to cast a vote against the party, just enough to sort of create an argument. But when they really need him, he's there. So when they really needed him on the tax bill, he's been there. You know, they let him at the last minute vote no on healthcare, but he was there on every vote leading up to it. So it's, we need to focus people's attention on how he actually votes in Washington, because at the end of all this, that's really what matters. And I think we can do that. I mean, part of what I hope to do is, you know, I can neutralize his advantage. Every single thing he says is, as a former undercover CIA officer, .. Mm-hmm. And that's his entire political brand. Well, look, that's the world I come from. That's what my parents did their whole lives. I've worked on the House Intelligence Committee. I've done national security cases. I've got my own alpha tough guy job. You're not going to have that advantage on me. So what's left? It's his voting record. So that'll be easier for us to focus on. Forget all this stuff that he's going to try and talk about. Focus on what he does. And what he does is not consistent with the values of this district.
And so when does it really get into full gear? Like, when is it, you know, war on the battleground in El Paso?
So the primary is March 6th, and we feel good about the primary, but we're taking it seriously, but things are looking good. And then we expect them to start really spending money to come after me then, and maybe before, frankly. When I was in Washington for a few meetings a few weeks ago, I had a tracker. So this is somebody walking up to me on the street with a camera rolling, someone that knew my name by sight, knew me, and was asking questions about guns, actually, trying to trap me. And so
then they take those videos and post them on social media.
Yeah, and try and splice them, dice them. So what we did with that, I actually told them the story about Lascano's gun, and how we traced it back, and why that's important for background checks. I just decided to treat this person like a reporter. I'm going to look at her and give an interview. We actually then found that recording on a Republican YouTube group, took it off, and gave it to Moms Demand Action. We go, look, they tried to trap me. Here it is. This is where I stand. It's the same thing I'm going to tell them. Moms Demand Action. Same thing I'm going to tell the Republicans. Same thing I'm going to tell the press. This is important. But it means that they're worried, and they're trying to play really early. And so we expect more dirty tricks, because when they don't really have an agenda, a policy agenda that is something that people will recognize as being able to help them, all they're left with is dirty
tricks. Let me ask you a question, and we're going to wrap up in a few minutes, but sure. Let's just pretend that you are running against you. What would your strategy be?
If I were running against me, I would resign and move on and leave it in the open seat. Hopefully they're listening. I don't think they'll do that. My guess is what they'll do is, you know, look, I didn't grow up in Texas. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've been in the district just about as long as Will Hurt has as an adult.
Yeah.
And we came back about the same time. But they'll probably do a you didn't grow up here. That's fine. You know what? It's true. My wife did. She's got long, deep roots in San Antonio. And, you know, you grow up without any roots. It was important to my wife that she lived near her family, so that's what we did. That's where we've chosen to raise our family and settle down. And if they want to try and make a liability of that, go ahead. Just like hundreds of thousands of other people who've moved to San Antonio over the last 10, 15 years who are from somewhere else. So that's one thing they'll do. They might attack me for my longtime friendship with the Castro brothers. I hope they do. I think that will backfire on them. We assume that whatever they will do will probably be fabricated. It will, this is what they do everywhere. I mean, so in a couple years ago, the Democrat used to have the seat, a guy named Pete Gallego, is a friend of mine. Pete Gallego ran in 2012 and won on a campaign about helping veterans. And most of what he did as a congressman was focused on helping veterans. And he was very effective at it. But the Republican attack ad 2 years later was all about how he was terrible for veterans. It was totally made up. And, it had its impact.
So how do you avoid that from happening to you?
So we've got to be ready for it. And we've got to be ready with our own response. And it's got to be quick. And it's got to be loud. And you can't let any attack go unanswered, even if it's, that's not true. I'm going to ignore it. You can't assume that it'll just pass or people will know it's false. You have to respond to everything.
So, just to wrap up here, how many seats are going to be in play in 18?
So it depends on, I think the Democratic Party is going to try and play in well more than the number that we need to take back the House. I think we're going to play in 50, 60, 70 different seats.
And how many do you guys need to take an SLA week, as I consider myself? 24, 25. What do you think the chances are that it happens?
Good.
Good.
I've met a lot of the people running in a lot of these other seats that got a lot of talent, really smart, accomplished people. There's a lot of energy out there in places that you wouldn't expect, like the north side of San Antonio or the Virginia suburbs. And there's a lot more activism than there's been in the past. And there's a sense of people don't want to just accept what's happening. It's not good enough. And they recognize that if you don't show up and vote, someone else is, and you're going to get what they want and not what you want, and you're going to get left with what we have now.
Which is a disaster.
Which is a disaster. That's right.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to chat today. This has been fascinating.
And
where can people follow you and donate to your campaign or whatever it is that they do in these instances?
Jayhulings.com, JAYHULINGS.com. That's our website.
Great. Thanks so much.
Great. Thank you.
Thanks to my guest today, Jay Hullings. If you enjoyed this conversation, be sure to listen and subscribe to other great episodes of Inside the Hive with Nick Bilton. You can find these on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or anywhere you get your podcasts. And don't forget to leave a nice review while you're there. Thanks to the folks at Cadence 13 for their production work and my editors at Vanity Fair. I will see you all next week.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.